I'm Carla Nappi, and this is New Books in East Asian Studies. Welcome, and thanks very much for joining us. I just got off the Skype phone with Michael Nylon and Greet Van Kierbergen to talk about their really wonderful and really, really important new edited volume, Chang'an 26 BCE, An Augustan Age in China. This came out in 2015 with the University of Washington Press, and it's full of really wonderful pieces, essays on various aspects of Western Han Chang'an that include, if you look at the three parts of the book, the built environment and the archaeology of the city, the socio-political transformations in late Western Han, and some leading figures in the late Western Han. Now, this is really a model as a volume of bringing together in every single aspect of the work archaeological and textual sources, not just in ways that make the point that it's important to do so, but that really model and show us the possibilities for re-envisioning what it can look like to work with and write stories with texts when we do so. The volume is a really important contribution, not just to how we understand and how we work with and envision early China. It's also a really wonderful resource for anybody working on researching, but also teaching urban history, the history of built environments, the history of empire, and much, much, much else. There are essays here on medicine. There are essays here on lots of different aspects of Western Han Chang'an. So it's a really important volume. I highly, highly recommend it. It's also illustrated with beautiful, some color images that are an integral part of the parts of the volume that they show up in. And so it's a volume that's really a pleasure, but also really informative and instructive to work with, as well as a volume that's got lots and lots of really important content. So I hope you enjoy. It was a pleasure to talk with both of them. And I actually learned a lot about the project and about their particular visions for the future of early Chinese studies. So I hope you enjoy. I hope you have a chance to get your hands on the volume. This is going to be something that will be on your bookshelf and will be used for many, many, many years to come. It's, I think, really a landmark in the field. So enjoy, and I hope you have a chance to take a look at it. Thanks for listening. I'm here today to talk with Michael Nylon and Greet Van Kierbergen about their really wonderful new edited volume, Chang'an 26 BCE. Welcome to New Books in East Asian Studies, Greet and Michael, and thanks for coordinating the group call and also for making time to speak with me today. I'm really looking forward to it.
Thank you for having us.
So let's start off, as is traditional for the channel, by saying a little bit about what brought you each to the field. So how did you come to work on early China specifically? And Michael, perhaps we can start with you.
When I began to be interested in China, it was in modern China, and there was actually no one in America working on early China, with the exception of David Keatley doing oracle bones in the Shang Dynasty, which was not what I wanted to do. So by very circuitous paths, I ended up at Cambridge, and I studied there with Michael Lowy, and then when my money ran out and I had to figure out what to do next. Again, no place in America. So I first went to Harvard, where I had hoped to work with Yang Liancheng, but as predicted, he was not in good mental shape at that time. And then I eventually transferred to Princeton, where they had failed to read my application, which said, "Don't accept me if you're not interested in having me do early China." Nonetheless, I soldiered through Princeton and eventually got my PhD there in a year when there were two jobs for all of China, and I was a woman. I was the first woman at Princeton in the history department, in East Asian, studying history. So chances, I mean, it's really an amazing fluke that I got a job. But I'll tell you what directed me to early China was the prose in Sima Qian Shiji, and the objects that were beginning to come out of China, including things like the Ma Wang Dui silk banner, beautiful paintings on silk. So I was driven by aesthetics for literary and artistic objects, and I've happily stayed here ever since.
Wow. So, Greed, what brought you to the study of early China?
I started out with a really academic interest. So it's a completely academic route in the sense that I studied, I'm from Belgium, and I studied at the University of Leuven, of the Catholic University of Louvain, and was studying philosophy. And it was all Western philosophy all throughout. And I was a little bit dissatisfied with, you know, what I was learning. And there was then one course where a professor was talking about Confucius and Mencius, and that got me interested in China. And just at that time, they were starting up a new program, you know, to teach modern Chinese with the tones and in a much better way than they had been doing it before. So I thought, this is my chance. So I started studying the language and started studying the history. And I think the reason why I ended up in early China is because of the kind of the texts that I was interested in at the early point in time are from that time period, even though now I'm, you know, no longer a student of these. I mean, I use them, but I'm starting to use them in a very different way than I would have approached them while I was a philosophy student. But then, so for graduate school, I went to the US, to Princeton, like Michael, even though I was studying there after Michael. And, you know, I stayed with early China, kind of moving in between text and history and trying to make the text part of history throughout.
So, Greet, can you tell us a little bit about, and tell listeners perhaps a little bit about, what kinds of texts you focus on when you're not editing a massive, incredibly important volume on Chang'an, right? Well, how does this particular volume fit for you into the kind of research trajectory that brought you here?
Well, my first book, my kind of the so-called dissertation book, is about the Huainanzi, which is a text from, you know, written during Emperor Wu's reign. And it was a bit of a strange story, because as I started to write that dissertation that then became a book, I really was at first interested in the ideas. But then the more I was doing it, the more I couldn't, you know, I felt I had to read Shiji and all the other sources available to understand why the text was saying what it was saying. So that's how I moved really from the Huainanzi, which is a, you know, I'm not sure whether it needs to be called a philosophical text, but moved from there then to kind of the more historical text, and trying to understand, I guess, any text, whether it's a part of a speech in Shiji or Hanshu, or another text that we find in a tomb, or a transmitted text as a rhetorical piece that is there to say something to someone about something. And so that kind of our job is to try to figure out kind of what that rhetorical setup is of any text. Including kind of the many texts that we used as we were kind of creating the volume that we're discussing today.
Thank you. And Michael, what brought you to a particular interest in this kind of urban history approach to Chang'an specifically, within the larger trajectory that you had been working on as you came to this volume?
Well, I have tried with every single project I've worked on to actually work on a completely different sort of a project. And this project came out of the fact that I was trying to think, I have quite a lot of graduate students working at very different levels of expertise. Some of them are in an MA program first year. Some of them are quite advanced. They read classical Chinese nearly as well as people who've been in the field much, much longer. So what I decided to do was pick a topic that all of them, regardless of their particular level of Chinese and also regardless of their particular research interests, could engage in. And I thought, oh, well, maybe doing something on an early city, those who are interested in archaeology, those who are interested in historical events, parsing them, those who are interested in cross-cultural natural history, all of these things could be working for them. So I went to our very fine East Asian library at UC Berkeley. And first of all, before going there, I did a search at UC Berkeley for how many books are on Rome. And it was literally, I can't remember the figures, but it was 5,000 or 6,000 books devoted in Western languages to the city of Rome. And I went to look what had been done on Chang'an, and there was nothing. Literally nothing. There have been a few books that took a chapter on Chang'an, but it's always Tang Chang'an. And so it immediately became apparent that we have a stunning lacuna. And so I thought, well, God, you know, no matter what happens, we need to plug this hole. So that was the genesis of the project, trying to think what would benefit my students working at different levels, but it never occurred to me that it would benefit the whole field if we were doing this.
Excellent. Thank you so much. So the book itself that we're talking about collects 19 essays, plus an introduction and an afterword and some really beautiful plates, some amazing images, and we'll talk a little bit about all of these things that are all devoted to exploring Western Han Chang'an. And you've talked a little bit about the genesis of the volume in the acknowledgments you mentioned as well, a kind of initial conference at Berkeley in 2011, Chang'an, 26 BCE, From Drains to Dreams, that kind of spurred the creation of the volume. Now, the volume does a really remarkable job, really, really, really remarkable, and I want to emphasize this for listeners because it's extraordinarily important in bringing together the work of Chinese and U.S. scholars. So let's talk a little bit about that. Can you talk about the particular challenges, the particular opportunities as well that this created for you both as editors of the project? And Greet, perhaps we can start with you. And can you speak to this a little bit?
So both at the conference and then, you know, afterwards, we had a number of scholars from China, Taiwan, Hong Kong, and then a number of scholars from North America. And then it, you know, we got like a few months later, we got all these essays in our inboxes. And it was a real challenge to try to kind of translate, but translate seems to be underestimating the task, you know, all those essays, in that the, and then we all know that the kind of the scholarly approaches in, let's say in East Asia are still very different from the way we approach, things here. And so it ended up being an extremely, prolonged, process of questioning our authors about very, very specific things. And it was a real learning process. So, I mean, I would say that many of the essays, and kind of most specifically the ones from scholars in the Chinese world, the way they ended up are not exactly the way they were in the beginning. And we really kind of, it was an almost endless exchange of questions, answers, new kind of every question generating new questions, etc. So it was a very interesting process to, you know, to try to make these essays appealing to audiences in kind of in North America.
Let me add something. I think I would agree with everything that Greet has said, of course. But our task was twofold, and I think we were very intent upon this twofold task. One was to make these authors aware of the sorts of questions that readers in Europe and America would be asking them, and so to flesh out their their essays in concert and continual collaboration with them. I think that was very much part of our task. And at the same time, so we wanted their essays to look like scholarly essays fully fleshed out in Euro-America. And at the same time, we wanted each and every one of the essays, no matter how technical, and we have some very technical essays, to be completely open for undergraduate or non-specialist teaching. Mm-hmm. And that, of course, ratcheted up the level of difficulty so that at times, I think Greet and I wondered how we ever got ourselves into this. But nonetheless, I think we maintain that goal because people who are non-specialists in China, people who are experts in Greece and Rome are continually asking us, what can we read? And we go, I'm sorry, it's all in Chinese, or I'm sorry, we're working on that, but it's not published. So we wanted a pretty comprehensive view of a major urban site in early China from every angle that could be thought of so that we could direct readers to this sort of a volume.
I mean, that's hard to do even with collected volumes of essays where everybody's a native English speaker, right? Sort of having that level of accessibility to a more general readership. And I think you've really succeeded here. So because the this collaboration between U.S. and China scholars is fairly rare, right, in terms of the how yes. central it is here. What are there for other scholars, other editors and authors who might also be interested in having more collaborative, polyvocal kinds of volumes like this? Are there any particular experiences that you had in putting this together that you feel were especially important for the success that you've had that you'd want to pass on as advice perhaps to other scholars and editors who might also be interested in bringing together these voices in a more concerted way? And perhaps, Michael, if you could start us off.
I think for me, the most important thing was establishing perfect goodwill and amity with our Chinese authors, because we were endlessly asking them to rethink things, to add information, which of course then we would duly translate, pushing them in ways that they confess never to have been pushed before. And so had there not I was very conscious when I was thinking of how to arrange the conference participants of asking scholars who really are focused on the work and always improving their work and never on their egos. Luckily, because we were working on a Chinese topic, we had I won't say multiple authors we could go to. There, for example, Liu Zhengui in Taiwan. No one else could have done what he did. I would say that's true for one or two other scholars. But the real question was, I feel that no matter how hard we pushed and how hard we changed things, we would all assume that we were working towards a common good. And so it transpired. So that was great.
Greet, what about you? Were there any elements of this that you feel additionally contributed to the particular success that you had in managing this collaboration?
Yeah, well, I was thinking in a slightly different direction, and of course, I endorse everything that Michael is saying, and she was a wonderful force in that whole process, you know, of bringing people together and keeping everyone together. The kind of what I'm thinking of is, since we're working on a geographical area, and you know, archaeology as a discipline is so important, and then also historical geography, which is a discipline perhaps more in China than it is in North America. So we also needed the expertise of those scholars, maybe not kind of immediately those who excavated the sites, but those who knew about the sites, who could take us to the sites, etc. So I think since geography and kind of the geographical dimension of our historical knowledge is becoming increasingly important, perhaps these kind of collaborations with scholars who know the terrain kind of much better than we do or will ever do becomes ever more necessary. And, you know, I think it's the way we'll have to keep doing things for the future too.
Let me just add one word. GREET and my own specialties and research interests are so, of course they converge in time, but are so different. It was really great to have two entirely different takes on every single essay. And when I would see what GREET was questioning, I would go, oh, great, that's what an ordinary reader would be questioning. And I'm sure it went vice versa. So I think that this also, it is, of course, everything is 10 times more labor intensive when more people are involved. But in the end, I think that's what made the volume user-friendly.
Mm-hmm. Now, the volume itself pays special attention to a number of aspects of the history of Chang'an, and one of the aspects that it pays attention to and really calls attention to the importance of this in the introduction is Chengdi, the figure of Chengdi. Now, this is an emperor who, as we learn from the introduction, is often dismissed as being of no significance in nativist scholarship and is often condemned as well. Now, that's not really the picture that we get here. So how does the picture of this major figure, the Chengdi figure, differ importantly in the volume from previous depictions of Chengdi? And what about that is particularly important in terms of your goals for the volume? And perhaps, Michael, we can start with you.
I thought it was, I began working on Chengdi because of the library project. He was the first to build a major imperial library that retrofitted many of the previous works and reformatted them in brand new forms. And I began to notice who was at Chengdi's court and go, well, you know, what is going on that all of the most famous people from Western Han, with the exception of Sima Qian, they're all at Chengdi's court. And then I just began keeping an eye out for what was Chengdi's reputation. And his reputation is as a debauched emperor who was never able to sire a child, he sired them, but they died right away. And the assumption was that he may or may not, either biologically or by acts of commission, may have actually even been complicit in their murders. And then I looked at how Wu Di was portrayed. And those of us who are Han historians, at least in Europe and America, think of Wu Di as a man of enormous promise, somewhat like Henry VIII, who then proceeded to waste everything he had been given. That he is famous in China simply because he extended the borders of China the furthest that they've ever been extended until modern times. So we have this enigmatic figure, Chengdi, and then we have Han Wudi, who garners all of the kudos, though Han Wudi kills, like Henry VIII, almost everyone around him. And Chengdi's manner of governance is much more hesitant, much more consultative, much more interesting from a modern point of view. So when I invited people to the conference, I said to them, I don't care what you write, you can take any topic you want, I simply want you to focus on Chengdi. And I have to say, all the people in China said, you're crazy. But we know you. I knew all of the people, most of them well, some of them at least we had corresponded. And I said, no, that's your task. I don't care what you find. I simply exactly want you to work on this topic. I think we'll come out with something interesting. And so that's the way a historian should approach topics. We don't care how it comes out. We simply are posing a series of interesting questions about a period that is way too understudied and a relatively enigmatic figure. And I think that's why it proved to be so much fun for many of us who worked on this period.
Now, Greet, you actually have a contribution to the volume, which is an essay that looks closely at Chengdi's relationships with kings, with high-ranking princes, right? So could mm-hmm. you maybe, in terms of contributing to this larger conversation of Chengdi and how the volume re-envisions and repositions Chengdi, could you tell us a little bit about what you take to be the most important aspects of what you're arguing in that chapter and why this is so important for you as a scholar?
Mm-hmm. Let me first say perhaps one more thing about Chengdi. I agree with what Michael is saying. And usually, when we talk about the Han Dynasty, we think of Wuti, and you know, then we don't make much differentiation about what happened afterwards. However, at the same time, it's not about, or to me, it's not so much about the figures of Wuti or Chengdi and kind of the way they were as persons. But we're also, and I think that's one of the achievements of the book, and there are certain essays that go a lot deeper in that than others, in trying to kind of not only highlight the figure of the emperor, but everyone that is working behind the scenes and on the scenes and with them. So all the different power groups. I'm thinking in particular of Luc Haberstadt's essay, which reveals that very, very well, kind of all those disputes at the court, and kind of really changes our view as to how we should look at power. So it's not just the figure of Chengdi, or kind of for the earlier period, the figure of Wuti, and kind of the general argument that we want to make is that this is a period where important changes are taking place, and not one person is responsible for all those changes, and that the period as a whole, kind of late Western Han, is generally we tend to underestimate its importance, and we really wanted to highlight how important that this is an important period of transition.
I was just going to add a sentence, not only an important period of transition, but many of the achievements that are assumed to be Han Wudi's actually only take place in late Western Han and at Chengdi's time. Mm-hmm. I think that those of us who are not historians often assume, well, an emperor has power and he knows what to do with it. It's really only Chengdi's court that figures out we have an empire and we can do things with it that have never been done before. So it's a little bit like Augustus versus Hadrian. Hadrian really has many more initiatives that are fully imperial. Augustus is just starting that.
So great. You were talking maybe a little bit about your particular contribution.
Yes. Uh-huh. Yes. So I think I really worked within that general framework of looking in detail at what was happening during Chengdi's reign, and then trying to situate it, against the wider kind of narrative or new narrative about Western Han history. And kind of the Zhuhe Wang, or the, you know, who were relatives of the emperor and who had important kingdoms throughout Western Han and also in Eastern Han, it's a group that's very often overlooked. And I've been doing kind of work on them in the past, kind of for different types of publications. So it's not because I work on them, but I think it's a group whose importance is often estimated, especially for the late Western Han period, where we think, you know, it's just the remnants of these important kingdoms that were in place, that were installed by Gaozu at the beginning of the Han Dynasty. So what I was trying to to do with a very detailed analysis is to show how they still were important, but important in a very different way than they were in the very beginning of the Han Dynasty. And kind of one of the arguments that I try to make is that because, you know, the Western Zhou more or less already had that institution of, you know, giving trusted relatives or kind of trusted generals and people like that, giving them land and giving them titles. And I mean, we kind of the end of Western Han is really, you know, a moment where they want to go back to the Western Zhou and to those institutions. So in a sense, it was important for them, even though those kingdoms were no longer powerful in terms of, you know, they didn't have much choice in the way they were running their kingdoms. At the same time, I think they're still, you know, a very important presence in the political landscape of the time. Great. And if I may add one thing is, what I also, I mean, this is about Han history, but it's also about Chang'an, because, and, you know, Tang Xiaofeng's essay really makes a, you know, points it out very beautifully. The Western Han Chang'an was not the same city throughout roughly 200 years. It was the Western Han capital, and it changed enormously. What I also am trying to show with you know, with my essay is that the role that Chang'an played in the imagination or in the lives of those kings who, you know, who had their kingdoms far away from the capital changed enormously. So in the beginning, you know, when you read sources of the earlier Western Han period, the kings they want to be as far away as possible from the capital. For the later period, you know, the capital really has become the heart and the soul of, I don't know how to call it, the empire, and somehow they want to maintain and they want to kind of strengthen their connections with the capital, and that's why I chose the title "Pining for the West." I mean, they start to really long for the capital and don't necessarily like being sent to their kingdoms anymore. So the capital becomes truly a capital during late Western Han.
Now, as a late imperial or early modern China scholar, the immediate thing that I thought of when I read that piece was, oh, this is really interesting in terms of the increasing attention that, you know, people like Craig Clunas, for example.
That's what I was thinking of.
Kings, right?
His Ming book on the local kings.
That's right. But then you remind us late in the book of the importance of understanding and being attentive to the differences, right, between late imperial contexts and the importance of not reading late imperial historiographical tendencies into the way we understand early China. And so I think this is really useful because it both gives us an opportunity to think across what might be divides, but also reminds us that thinking across needs to be done very circumspectly and very carefully and without assuming that we're talking about the same sorts of things, even when there seem to be resonances that make for productive conversation. Mm-hmm. Right. So another really interesting part of the volume is its emphasis on and its asking of readers to pay attention to the importance of the built environment of Chengdi's capital. And there's a lot of really interesting stuff happening here in terms of sort of attentiveness to the architecture, to the ways that we might read decorative sources as texts, or decorative surfaces rather as texts, and sort of there's an attention to parkland and gardens, etc. Now, one of the important factors that allows the existence of gardens and parkland and ponds and features like this, of course, is water in the city. And Michael, your contribution to the volume talks a lot about and brings us into the importance of provisioning the capital, both with water, but also with food. So could you maybe take us into what you take to be some of the most important aspects of what you're arguing in your contribution to the volume in terms of the essay on provisions?
Yes, well, I decided that I, as editor, would take any topic that no one else ended up taking at the conference. And it became so clear to me immediately that we needed to talk about provisioning the city. And provisioning the city in ancient times must be done by water. It's just too expensive to do it any other way. So I really knew nothing about the topic of water and food provisioning. And so this was a great exploration for me. And I had a wonderful model. There's a book called Ancient Rome by Colson and Dodge that has wonderful essays about transportation and provisioning the city in it. And so that helped me figure out, well, what are the questions I should at least be asking? I also was fortunate enough, there's really growing interest among archaeologists in China to reconstruct part of the water systems, the great water systems, especially around capitals. And so I was able to avail myself of brand new, literally as I was writing, things were coming out, essays and a book on basically Chang'an water systems. Because everything is so new, there were many aspects of it that literally people hadn't pieced together, even in this marvelous book that I'm thinking of in Chinese on the water resources around Han Chang'an. In other words, they were trying to do pieces and pieces, which is how we get bits of information, bits from archaeology, bits from the official histories. At points, work is so preliminary, the real job was to put this kind of thing together. And what I found very, very exciting was being able to work closely with map makers that would help me envision how things were changing from one point to another. And so I really owe great thanks to Bill Nelson, for example, and as well as the Xi'an archaeologist and historical geographers. But it was very exciting. And then Rafe de Crepigny, a student of Hans Bielenstein, was kind enough. He's been working on Luoyang to act as a second reader for everything I was working on, as well as Brian Lander, a brand new PhD who was working in the archaeology of the area. So this became, you know, everyone kind of pulling together, oh, I found this piece of information, oh, I found this. And in the end, I think we really know more about provisioning the city with water, fresh water, unpolluted water, and with food than we ever knew before. And as Chang'an mausoleum towns start growing their ever greater population, eventually we have far more people in the area than were at Rome, and therefore far greater problems in how do we feed these people and how do we make sure their water is untainted.
Thank you so much. Now, we've talked about different kinds of linkages, and so this linkage through water is one example. We've talked a little bit about linkages and the kinds of challenges of making linkages across time, right, between late imperial and early contexts. We've also talked very briefly, I think Greet was mentioning the importance of linking textual with archaeological sources, and this really happens throughout the volume, and we can talk a little bit more about that later if you'd like. But there's also another very important linkage that's been underlying a lot of our conversation, but that's very, very important throughout the volume, and that's the importance of linking Chang'an to wider cross-cultural, cross-local kinds of questions. So this is, I think, because it's so important, let's devote some time to talking about this. Can you speak to, just to get us started, why this was so important to you as a major contribution to the volume. Why is it so important for us to think about Chang'an in the context of these wider cross-cultural kinds of questions and stories? And Greet, perhaps you can get us started on that.
Well, I'm thinking of all the walls that were in. At first, there were no walls around Chang'an, but then, in you know, under Huiti's reign, very early on in the 90s, walls were built around the city. And what I'm often struck by is that you cannot have a wall without having a gate in the wall. And if you have a gate, you have to have many people. I mean, you have kind of exchanges of people who come through the gate. And so those, so in a way, I mean, of course, the walls are very important. They tell us many things. But I also think that, you know, we wanted to focus more on the gates as places of exchange. So where people came, sometimes, you know, you could have, you know, people from foreign places, merchants from all over China, people who were trying to make their political fortunes in Chang'an, students who came from everywhere. So as Chang'an was growing in importance, it also became, you know, it... yeah, the kind of it became the place to be. So I really don't think that you can you know, study a city merely as a static site, but you really have to kind of try to make it as dynamic as possible and to, you know, see all the exchanges that are constantly going on. And of course, that we, you know, if you merely give a description of, you know, there was a palace there, there were walls there, these are the dimensions, you're not going to get at it. And, you know, what we've done in the volume, I think, is only a start. I think there is a lot more that can be done in that respect. Another perhaps important aspect is, you know, there were other major cities in the Western Han Empire, and somehow Chang'an also needed to profile itself against those other cities. And, you know, if I'm thinking of Linzi in the state of Qi, in what is now Shantung, which was an enormously flourishing city and was perhaps more flourishing in early Western Han times than was Chang'an. So there is also this kind of interregional competition going on, which is very interesting to observe and follow.
Michael, did you want to speak to this?
Yes, I do. I think that there's more and more interest among classicists of ancient Greece and Rome than before in what was going on in comparable situations. My own teachers include Nathan Sivan, who worked very closely with Jeffrey Lloyd, trying to sketch out what was ancient paideia in early China versus Athens. I think that we are really hungry to understand how ancient empires managed in times where there was such poor transportation and communication to hold themselves together, partly because these ancient empires loom large in the consciousness of people. I think many people think they know about Rome simply because they read about it in fifth grade in America, and certainly in China, many people would say, "Oh, I know all about Chang'an." But it's really the details that, when you get down to them, that it's very startling. That let's take Rome and early China, that we have empires of approximately the same size and the same population that are run on completely different bases, economically and politically, aside from the fact that eventually we get monarchs for both of them. The way the monarchies run is quite different. And I think that what people need to realize is that In a sense, we have choices and things are not run biologically or in primary school. That doesn't have to be the only range of options that one can think about as we move forward in the future politically.
Right. And in the volume, actually, you are very careful to articulate at least some of those really important differences, right? And among them, Chang'an did not rely on slave labor. And this is, and with, you know, Game of Thrones in the background and the memory of lots of people watching Daenerys Targaryen create her empire, this issue of slave labor and empire and the growth of empire is actually probably really important culturally right now in our sphere, if we take TV as any indication. But this is just one, and I'm being a little flip here, but not entirely.
No, not entirely, because first of all, in Chinese, as you well know, there's no word to distinguish bondservant and slave. So even many Chinese assume that there was a much larger slave population than in term bondservants, what we would call indentured servants. So there's misapprehension all the way around.
Right. And this is important, I think, to speak to broader perhaps more global historiographical concerns that are emerging across fields right now. I think in a lot of humanistic fields, there's an increasing attention toward labor. I mean, I think in a lot of us, for a lot of us who are working in academic environments where issues of labor and the politics of labor are becoming increasingly important and trenchant and really part of what we think about and argue about and are attentive to in our daily lives, that's coming up more and more as a concern in a lot of our humanistic field. And this is at least one of many ways that this particular early history can speak to and can help us articulate ways to be more attentive to issues of labor and local contexts of labor across empires. But this is just one of many ways, right, that Western Han, Chang'an, and Rome were actually quite different. Can we talk about maybe some of the other ways that you think are particularly important in terms of how we understand the connections and the relationships in this broader imperial history? And Greet, perhaps if you can get us started, what are some of the most important ways that Western Han, Chang'an, and Rome were importantly different in terms of how we think about them?
Well, there is definitely, you know, if even in merely physical terms, Rome was built kind of with a lot of stone and later on also marble. And so a lot of it remains. And so when you go to Rome nowadays, you can still see lots of the remains of, you know, the Forum Romanum and lots of other remains from the Republican period, from the imperial period in Rome. The case with Chang'an is completely different, where, you know, we have only, you know, post holes and, you know, sites underground that are, you know, after they've been, if they're excavated and afterwards, you know, they're returned, kind of they put earth over them again. So, and they put a few objects out in museums. So the physicality of it all is very, very different. I'm sure Michael, you know, will have lots to add to this. But what I think is also very interesting is how, of course, Western Han Chang'an was the capital for 200 years. But then, and it continued to play an important role even after that. But then the capital was moved to Luoyang. So the idea, and also Western Han Chang'an, kind of its location towards Xi'an is not exactly where the Qin capital was. It's not exactly where the Zhou capitals were, even though they were in the same area. It's not in the same place as the Sui and Tang capital was. So kind of the idea that with an incoming or a changes in the dynasty, you go to a new place somehow. And even though the area is not new, it's very interesting to me and something, you know, I'm trying to wrap my mind around even now.
Michael, did you have anything to add here? You talk a little bit in the introduction, in particular, about the differences in terms of power and its relationship to the military or not in these contexts, and also the figure of the emperor in these contexts being quite different. Did you want to speak to that a little bit?
Sure, I'll speak to that briefly. One of the ideas that I've become convinced of is that the logics of legitimacy in ancient Rome and ancient China were completely different. What Rome offered its elites and commoners as a way to get them to buy into the Roman Empire was really quite different. Rome offered elites, basically, many of them stayed more or less with their structures unchanged on the local level, as long as they paid taxes to Rome. That the Chinese conceived what an empire should do quite a bit differently. They wanted to really assimilate their populations to the degree that it was possible given the conditions of the time. And I taught a course with my wonderful colleague, Carlos Noreña, who's also a contributor to the book. He's a Roman historian. And we concluded that in some sense, the real Rome-China contrast that we should be looking at is that Rome, at the height of its extent, had fewer than 1,000 officials to run the empire, all of them unpaid, all of them from the senatorial class. And that in Han Chang'an, we had 100 of coming out from Han Chang'an, we had 130,000 paid upper level administrators, each of whom we can imagine had between 10 and 20 people working on their staffs. So the level of aspiration for penetration, real penetration into the outlying regions, is just on a scale that's quite different. Therefore, aside from Wu Di, most of the expenses of running the Han Empire went typically to the paying the administrators, the vast bureaucracy that China really invented, the notion of bureaucracy.
And this is actually one of this acknowledgement of this deep administrative penetration is one among others of some of the major methodological contributions to the volume, right? And we're reminded of this both early and late, in addition to this and in addition to pointing us to the importance, again, of disaggregating our historiographical approaches to late imperial and to early contexts. There's a lot of attention to an analysis of the metaphysical topography, as you put it here, of the capital. There's more attention here to conventions of the rhetoric of Han texts, rather than just simply reading the semantic content of text as if it's a transparent window into, you know, unproblematic meaning. There's also an important move here that asks us to disambiguate the Western and the Eastern Han, right, and to think about these in terms of difference as well. But you also point us here to some important future directions that the field might take, that this is perhaps a springboard for and a window into. One of those important future directions might be, Michael, as I think you put it in one of your contributions here, an increased attention to the social glues, as you put it, that bind disparate regions and groups in the Western Han. And you you ask us to think about the possibility of the kind of physicality of ornamental roof tile ends and tower gates, right, as being possibly part of this social glue. Did you want to maybe, Michael, talk about that a little bit and perhaps move from that into some of talking about some of what you take to be other important possible future directions that this might open us up into?
Well, as everyone here probably knows, Roman historians argue that when so many people were illiterate, the Roman Empire could never have stuck together were it not for all those Roman heads on coins and Roman statues of emperors in the fora. But, of course, we don't have heads of emperors or anybody else on on Chinese coins, nor do we have statues in the fora. We probably have only slightly more literate populations. So I began to ask, what is holding things together? What would make you feel you were part of an empire? And of course, part of what you would make you feel you were an empire is this density of administrators. But you need visuals. If you are illiterate, you may never get to see your local administrator. In fact, you hope you never see your local administrator, because you'd probably only seeing him if he was judging you for a crime. So I began to say, what would you see every place around that would mark buildings? And I think what would mark these buildings would be impressive architecture in wood. But more to the point, these roof tile ends, these ornamental, beautiful roof tile ends that sometimes have animals on them, sometimes have Chinese stylized characters that even people who could have basic literacy would not be able to parse, but that are spectacularly beautiful. And these would have ornamented every impressive roofline of every impressive governmental building, all the way up from, let's say, the county administrator's compound to the palaces in Hanchang'an. So I am very interested in the visual. I was trained as an archaeologist in the Institute of Archaeology in China. And I'm always thinking about what could you see in sight lines, and what is visual, and what are people in their daily lives dealing with. One of my next projects is about non-elites and what we can and cannot say about them. And I'm spurred by this by two books, one done by a Berkeley professor and one done by someone at the University of Texas at Austin. One is about visual materials and what you could and could not see art in the lives of ordinary people in Imperial Rome. And the other one from my wonderful colleague, Professor Knapp, is parsing, of course we can't say much about non-elites in the Roman Empire, but if we work a little bit harder, could we not say a little bit more? And I think certainly for the Chang'an area, we could say quite a bit more. And I've been working with an archaeologist in Chang'an who's interested in the lives of non-elites. And I think that will be one of the future directions that I try to go in myself.
Great. For you, what are some of the most important, promising future directions of scholarship on this period that you see coming out of the contributions that the volume's making?
Mm-hmm. Maybe rather than focus on a specific group such as elites or non-elites, or, you know, and of course that all needs to be done, but I'm very interested in the idea of kind of movements and how people move throughout the empire and how Chang'an functions as people of all, you know, all backgrounds and ranks, and not everyone, of course, travels, but many of them do, and perhaps more than we would imagine. Why that happens, how that happens, and how all that movement ultimately contributes to the creation of something, you know, we might call an empire. So that's something that interests me. We have kind of registration, a given, you know, you don't just go to Chang'an and say, now my registration is in Chang'an. It's a very complicated process to do it. And I'm always trying to be attentive to how this happens, in what context, how people get to move, either a single man or bring their families, what their relations are with their, you know, their hometowns, etc. Kind of, these are all kind of important themes that remain important throughout Chinese history. But I think the way things play out in late Western Han is still substantially different from how, you know, how things are done later on. So,
And I think this actually really speaks to, in addition to pointing us to important differences, it also speaks to, I think, an emerging sense, again, across humanistic disciplines, but in particular among historians, of the importance of mobility, right? Mm-hmm. We're getting more and more histories that emphasize mobility and mobilities in empires and beyond. And this is a way, I think, to speak really nicely to that emerging trend as well.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So in addition, there are lots of things that we can talk about, right? And other future directions that you mentioned in the volume include to kind of speak to something that Michael mentioned at the very beginning when mentioning the Imperial Library Project, right? And the volume's also turning us to look at the importance of libraries as opposed to just archives in terms of the creation of knowledge in these contexts, asking us to look at the differences between oral and written habits that distinguish print and manuscript cultures, and asking us to move behind looking at certain sections of standard histories, right, which have often preoccupied historians, to look at other more neglected aspects of standard histories that might open up new kinds of stories, like I think you mentioned tables and treatises and hereditary houses. So there's lots of possibilities here that are opened up by the contributions to the volume, and that might open up into other possibilities as well. So there's a ton of stuff, right, that we haven't talked about. But as we come to the conclusion of our conversation, of course, you know, we can't possibly be comprehensive. And I urge listeners to get a copy of the volume because, as you mentioned, it's really, really useful, not just for researchers, but also for those of us who teach, and who teach not just China courses, but also more kind of global historical courses that give us resources to do that and integrate Western Han Chang'an into those larger stories. Is there anything in particular, though, that we didn't have a chance to talk about, but that you'd like to mention for listeners? And perhaps, Greet, we can start with you.
You know, perhaps one thing. I mean, you've emphasized a couple of times how you know, we don't want to assume, you know, things in the Han were the same as they were in late imperial China. I think very often when we think of a Chinese capital specifically, we tend to think of the Forbidden City. And I just want to make the point that Han Chang'an is nothing like the Forbidden City. And it's fascinating kind of the ways in which it diverges from kind of a neat plan like it. And, you know, I think that's, you know, something I wanted to just posit and make clear.
Following up on that comment, I think that the really exciting thing about the volume for me boils down to two things. One, that we see people for the first time conceptualizing empire as they're going about over the course of their daily lives at court and beyond. They're really having to make things up as they go. And so many of the institutions that are being formed in Western Han, but specifically in late Western Han, then become the paradigms for much of later Chinese history, and then they become the precedents. But what we can see in our texts is people really wrestling with how do we set this up properly so that we benefit parties, disparate parties in the empire. And I think, of course, that's an ongoing question in America. How do we set up politics so that it can benefit disparate parties? So I would like to emphasize that I think many of the questions, underlying structural questions that the volume raises, are not only about early classical civilizations, but are of enduring relevance today. I guess the one other thing I'd really like to emphasize to people who don't know the volume is how spectacularly well integrated color, photographs, tables, outlines of the city and aspects of the city, line drawings, all of these things, so that there's never a moment in the text where you're very far from an illuminating map or some other visual aid. And that's, of course, quite conscious from the editors. We really wanted people to enter into this world world visually as well as through reading. So I think those are very important aspects of the volume.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And thank you for emphasizing that, because it's one of the things that makes the volume so useful. And the images, at least from the perspective of one reader, right, which is all I can really speak to, they're really integrated insofar as they're not simply illustrations, right? We're reading the images as well as reading the text. And I think that's a really nice way of asking us to engage with the volume in the way that you're modeling engagement with the kinds of sources of Western Han Chang'an history in the content of the pieces. So, Michael, you've said a little bit about what you're kind of interested in working on in the future, but what are you working on now? What's next for you? And are there any projects that are currently really inspiring you now that the volume's out?
Well, aside from the non-elite project, which will take a long time to complete, I am working on two projects. One is I've been working for 15 years on a book called, which will be about pleasure theories in early China, contrasting them with pleasure theories in ancient Greece. That's incredibly important to me because I think very few people that I've talked to have thought about these issues in relation. Our view of the distant past in China has often been Christianized. It's not surprising we read much of it through missionaries. I really want to speak to part of the logics of legitimacy is how people get pleasure and how government institutions provide them opportunities for pleasure taking and pleasure giving, but how those also exist on much smaller levels. So that I'm working on this book, and I'm actually nearly finished with it, to my great surprise. Some people have said I didn't want to finish it because it was too pleasurable to work on, but I've decided it needs to be finished after 15 years, and I'm wrapping it up. It should be done by Christmas. And then wow. I've begun a really difficult, fully collaborative work with a European scholar and with a Chinese scholar on translating the most difficult classic, The Documents. And we're translating it not according to a modern assumption that there should be an Ur text. We don't believe there was ever an original text for this. We believe there were many circulating manuscripts. We're translating it by Han Dynasty commentaries and creating a text that reflects Han and pre-Han views of this document's classic. It's a major undertaking, and it's incredibly rigorous, and thank God we've got a German on the team reminding us of all the methodological pitfalls. This is, I was doing it as an act of filial piety to a teacher of mine, Paul Sorois, but it has become a fully pleasurable endeavor on its own.
Wonderful. So, Greet, what are you currently working on, and what's next for you?
I have several. I seem to be having several little projects, but then some larger ones as well. In terms of translation, I'm not working on the documents itself, but on an early Western Han commentary on the documents, which the Shangshu Dazhuan, the great commentary on the Shangshu, which was extremely influential in throughout Eastern Han and slightly beyond. So I've done a translation with Lin Fan, and we're also finishing it up. It's a very complex textual history, and then we're also trying to write an introduction that kind of tells the readers where exactly this text fits in the times. Then I also have I feel the project, the book project that we've on Chang'an in late Western Han has opened up so many perspectives that I still would like to pursue, even though they seem like they're a little bit more than loose ends, but kind of I'm fascinated by the reasons why, for example, the decision was made, and kind of people were arguing for that already in Western Han, to move the capital to Luoyang. And I'm also very interested in how kind of how and why later texts, such as the Sanfu Huang Tu, which is an important source for us, is remembering kind of the Western Han, the Qin and the Western Han capital region. So I'm trying to kind of work on projects in that direction. And then the other thing is the nobles, so the kings, but also kind of the Ho, the Lie Ho. We're finding so much more archaeological material about them that I think it's time to try to reevaluate what their role was in kind of in the Han and kind of how this role was changing over time. So that I see as my next big project, but I'm very, very far from completing that. So still a lot of work to do.
Well, thank you to both of you. This all sound great. And thanks so much for making time to talk with me. It's an extraordinarily accomplished volume. It's a really important volume. And I'm really grateful to the both of you for making time to talk about it. It's really been a pleasure.
We are grateful for such a good reader and interviewer. May all of our readers be like
yes.
you.
Thank you. And so. It's really nice how you bring out, you know, certain things from your own, you know, from your own engagement with your field. So it's really interesting to talk across fields that way. So thank you very much.
Thank you. You've been listening to New Books in East Asian Studies. Thanks very much for joining us, and we'll see you next time.